Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
My name's Catherine Carr, and this is Relatively, the podcast all about potentially the longest relationships of your life.
That's perfect.
I'll be bringing siblings together to talk about the connections they have as adults, as well as what it was like growing up together.
We could all easily pick up a towel, sniff it, and say not only who had last used it, but where on the body they had used it.
This week, we're talking to author, journalist and broadcaster Catlin Moran.
I am the oldest and therefore arguably, and I would say scientifically, probably the best.
And her little sister, the comedy writer, Kaz Moran.
I feel a little bit queasy.
Kaz feels a bit queasy. I'm just vaping through it like some kind of a hero.
But I'll also talk to them separately to get a more private take on the relationship.
I'll do my intimate radio voice then.
I'll get the hell out of here.
Kaz was feminist and clever way before me, so she'd observed that if you were a bright and cheerful girl, that traditionally through history, that was how big families had screwed over their daughters.
She sort of modelled herself on Judy Garland and sort of plucky Victorian heroines. It was very at odds with a depressing 1980s Wolverhampton council estate.
And with the help of our sponsors, Find My Past, we'll be delving a little further back into the family history of all of our guests.
Yes.
What?
Yep. Yeah. EastEnders. You're not my mother.
Brothers and sisters are never straightforward. Catlin, Kaz, and their six other siblings grew up in Wolverhampton. The sisters have since written a TV series about their childhood called Raised by Wolves. We talk about that, about libraries, buses, thwarted ambition, Carl Jung, the ornaments your nan had, and the science of sibling roles. But Catlin, who took part in this episode while on holiday with Kaz and all the rest of the siblings, who at the time had come down with a sickness bug, started by listing the other brothers and sisters in the Moran tribe.
It's Claire, then John, then Corin, then Cheryl, then Jim, then Joe. And I only pause because none of us call each other by those names. We all have a variety of nicknames so embedded that I think one of us actually has that name on their passport now.
It must be like almost handbook worthy joining your family as a partner. Don't you need some sort of diagram or...
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of relationship admin in the early stages of a relationship where you have to sort of go, boom, here's the family history and there's this one and this one and that.
Yeah, so I am Buzmik or you Wum. My real name isn't Catlin Moran, it's Catherine Moran. And I changed it to Catlin when I read a book by Jilly Cooper at the age of 13 and thought Catlin sounded more like Irish and kind of cool and aspirational than Catherine.
I won't take offence at this point, but yeah, keep going.
Yeah. Sauce. And it was spelt with a C as well. I think it looks beautiful, but I aspired to being more Celtic and real and pretend I'd come from Ireland. Kaz is Kaz. Claire is Weena. John is Eddie. Corin is Cole. Cheryl is Gizmo. Jimmy's Jimmy, but also Merlin the Happy Pig, and Joe is Joe Fish.
I mean, I'm sure there's a story behind each and every one of those, but perhaps we could focus on yours. Where did your nickname come from?
So Buzmik is because as the eldest, I was the first to develop bosoms. So it was
it's quite simple.
Some big news in the town. So all the other siblings were like, "What's that?" Okay, you are now Buzmik, and then woman. Yeah, I'm called You Woman because I was the first one to become a woman. So the main thing that I would have shouted at me would be, You Wum, where are the scissors?
There are sort of friends of the family who take great pride in the fact that they have met all the siblings. It's like kind of getting all the trading cards in a trading card game.
A Blue Peter badge moment kind of thing.
Yes, yeah, a lifetime achievement award.
So what I didn't ask you individually and would be remiss of me not to have at the beginning of the podcast for people who haven't seen Raised by Wolves or read about your childhood, I wonder if you could sort of describe really basically what your childhood was like and what made it different, please.
Well, there were eventually eight of us. We were all home educated. So I had 2 years of school. You had five?
I was there till 11. So the cutoff date was 86. So whatever age you were at that point, that's where we all came out of school.
So whatever your knowledge was at that point, if you'd learned to read and write, great, good for you. If you hadn't, good luck. And then, we were in a three-bedroom council house on a quite dull and not scary council estate in Wolverhampton.
Good bus service though, 512 and the 513 every 20 minutes.
Yeah, very good bus.
There were three very good libraries within walking distance. So one of the things that we wanted to do in Raised by Wolves was just show working class sort of council estate life not being all scary and like kind of like rats and people on drugs, like having sex on burning mattresses and kind of like beating each other up. Most council estates aren't like that. They're like brilliant provision of housing post-war for people who didn't have much money. There's something really beautiful about the idea of like nothing too good for the working man. Why should these people not just have a house with a back garden and a bus?
And also buses to libraries. I mean, that's a theme on this podcast. A lot of kids, Bobby Siegel and his brother, same thing, every Saturday to the library. Nick and Jill Hornby, same thing, every Saturday to the library.
Once a week, lightweights.
Yeah.
We went every day.
Yeah.
But they were at school.
Oh, yeah. True.
Again, stuff, lightweights, I still judge them. Like sometimes we go twice a day because I used to get really paranoid that someone might have returned a book I wanted to read and it might be on the returns cart and not have been put on the shelf yet.
The getting of the teenage library ticket was like a big kind of life event, wasn't it?
The
like,
green
yes,
card.
I'm allowed into the adult area now.
Yeah, and Kaz was the first person I knew who had to demarcate the value of reading a book with your eyes and listening to audiobooks. There was one point where you were like, no, I've read all of them with my eyes. It wasn't an audiobook.
So when you were growing up with all these siblings in your house in Wolverhampton, like often the oldest daughter, and I hate to be gendered about it, but it's true, turns into the second mum if there's a big clutch of children following after. I wonder whether that was the case in your household, unusual as it was.
Very much so. I mean, my mother was constantly pregnant and my dad was constantly, I want to say, lazy. He seemed to be a sort of primarily horizontally based person. He just liked watching the Grand Prix. And also I'd read a lot of 19th century novels about cheerful, hardworking girls who simply by being fabulous homemakers would overcome terrible deprivation and marry Mr. Rochester. Only after his house had burned down and he'd gone blind, because if you're working class, you won't get a whole Mr. Rochester. You only get him when his eyes have been burnt out.
She sort of modelled herself on Judy Garland and sort of plucky Victorian heroines. It was very at odds with kind of, you know, depressing 1980s Wolverhampton council estate in the midst of, you know, economic gloom and cultural turbulence. She was almost a woman out of time in some ways. I think she saw Summer Stock. I think it's a Judy Garland and Gene Kelly film about them putting on a show under difficult circumstances. And I think that sort of went deep for her. And then much of her life has been about putting on a show under difficult circumstances.
So I was very much kind of like, I'll be good and shining and I will triumph. And I also really did and still do enjoy solutions to things. So I'd always be like cutting down a cardboard box and attaching a shoelace to it and then making it into a new shoe storage system that you could pop under a kitchen unit. Or there was one diary entry that was like, beautiful day today, relocated the deep fat fryer from the worktop on the left to the worktop on the right. Looks fabulous. So that was the level I was at. Kaz was playing a really different game. Kaz was feminist and clever way before me. So she'd observed that if you were a bright and cheerful girl, that traditionally through history, that was how big families had screwed over their daughters. So she became brilliantly surly and non-cooperative. So for instance, we were all enraged by the fact our parents, they would always be asking, oh, make us a cup of tea, make us a cup of coffee. And I would like make a cup of coffee and serve it on a tray with a flower picked from the garden, because that's what they do in novels. Kaz, meanwhile, would just make it using the hot tap and spit in it. So they never asked her again, which was a much cleverer thing to do.
And what about you? How would you describe yourself when you were growing up? What was your character like in contrast perhaps to that?
I was extremely grumpy, sarcastic, very depressed, very quiet, extremely introverted, which I remain to this day. It's almost like we were casting ourselves in a sitcom. You know, they are the two characters you would put together, the grumpy, sarcastic one, and then the have-a-go hero. So yeah, we were laying out some comedic archetypes there, I think.
I always presumed that a BBC film crew were filming through the kitchen window going, look at this girl. She comes from such unpromising beginnings, but the cheerfulness in her heart enchants all that see it.
And yet, have you been great friends all the way through, even when you were being sort of your best little woman self and she was being something else entirely?
there were like proper full-on fights and stuff, but there's a weird, and I think a lot of people have this with their siblings, there's a kind of arguing slash bickering you do that feels really comforting and pleasurable and like an exchange of love. And similarly, you can very often get into a mindset where you kind of want your sibling to wrestle you or hit you. You're deliberately provoking them. And at the point where you're finally rolling around on the floor, it feels like love. There's no kind of real proper anger to it. I'm sure when Kaz tells you this bit, she'll be like, no, and I found it very, very upsetting. And I've just been in therapy ever since. It was horrible. The constant bickering and the sort of like piss taking that we have in our family is my happy place.
I don't know, there's a certain joy to it. There's always that comfort of kind of, you know your sibling role. And so I would sort of sink into my curmudgeonly manner, and that would just give her more energy in a way. And she would sort of live out all of my extrovert leanings, and I would live out all of her introvert leanings. And so we were sort of a yin and yang to each other, I guess.
I've never heard it described like that before on this podcast. And I think that's really interesting that you sort of lean into it as a almost service to your sibling.
Yeah, sort of facilitating each other, and kind of, we were so immersed in television and sort of television archetype, and you do almost take on a sort of slightly parodic role, especially when you're a teenager. It's quite fun to just be like, okay, well, I'm just going to give you the grumpiest, surliest, meanest, sarcastic version of a grumpy teenager. And then, yeah, that sort of gave Kate life to be the exact opposite. Mm. In that never-ending search for kind of what your role is in a big family, because you know a lot of those spots have been taken, so you kind of have to fight for how you position yourself, what your brand is as a sibling.
It is a well-known thing in sibling psychology, apparently, that it's like there's labels and roles on the table, and once one is taken, it's taken. And the way that siblings totally think about it is like, you're the funny one, shit. Okay, I'm going to be this one, and you can't
literally this,
but you can split the role. It's so absurd. It's absurd.
But that's why in like big families, and this is why I'd be really interested to see a study of this in Victorian families, where sort of like, you know, 10 was the norm. Because apparently there are 5 major personality types. So once you get to like the sixth child, you've either got to double up and go around again or start inventing new kinds of people.
And how do you think she would describe you? Would she describe you exactly like that, do you think?
I think she would say that I was basically that I'm Toad of Toad Hall. I'm just this kind of cheerful thing just going, hurrah! Every so often when I go down hard, and then everybody has to rally around me and be like, it's okay. But yeah, just this kind of blustering idiot, which I really like, because the rest of the time I think of myself as this kind of tortured intellectual, just really trying to see into the future and just take humanity with me in my bare hands. And then within the family, I'm just like, pop, pop. Also literally, because I'm a very gaseous person, and I'm the one in the family that will like walk around naked. I will fart very loudly. I'll start a conversation about cystitis. Like, I'm a kind of disgustingness engine. Everybody else has better manners, let's face it.
And did you have a choice but to be kind of known intimately like that in a house full of kids? Like, there's not much space if there's that many children in the house, or were some people fighting for privacy and just sort of dying for a room of their own?
Well, Kaz was fighting for privacy, definitely, not least because I would read her diary and then leave notes in the margin, which she then would read my diary and leave notes in the margin.
Excellent note edits.
which was the basis of us starting to write scripts together 20 years later. But there was one very tortured entry I wrote in my diary about how I fancied this boy called Lee. Kaz just wrote in red felt tip pen next to this entry about how much I loved him and how beautiful he was and how he looked so much like Luke in Star Wars. She just wrote, he's a donkey, in red felt tip pen in my diary. So she was right.
Yeah, it was very much a house with no personal space. I mean, we were all sharing bedrooms for a very long time. There were no lock on the bathroom door, so privacy was in short supply, rather. I had a kind of horrible old man suitcase that we'd got from a jumble sale that had I don't know if it had a lock, but you could sort of like close the catch. And I felt like that was maybe some sort of privacy. I would like to think that there are some of my diaries that she didn't read. It was very, very transgressive, but there was something a bit fascinating about kind of getting into your siblings' inner thoughts. And then, of course, as soon as we became aware that everyone was reading each other's diaries, they became quite performative, and we would lay traps for each other in them, and you were aware you were writing for an audience. And, you know, perhaps that's what shaped us as the writers we went on to become.
I wondered, when you wrote Raised by Wolves and you agreed, obviously, between you, the parameters, what was up for grabs and what wasn't, the truth, the extent of the truth that you would tell, what that process was like, and obviously the stuff you've kept back, and what that felt like to decide what to tell and what not to tell. Or maybe it's all out there. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I guess we were very aware it was a comedy, and so we've written an entertainment angle that probably wasn't present all of the time back in the day.
It'd be very easy for that sitcom to be like Ken Loach. You know, we could have gone full kind of misery memoir, Dead Kestrel at the end of it. Mm. Again, people like crying on burning mattresses on a sort of like on a terrible estate.
I don't know that I did ever cry on a burning mattress. That would have also been slightly disingenuous.
I cried on a wet mattress because the dog used to piss on my mattress every night. Yeah, so yeah.
That's less dramatic though, isn't it? Yeah. Crying on a
quite funny though. Yeah. Trying to dry a dog piss stained mattress with a very underpaired hairdryer that would frequently overheat. Yeah, that's a very key sound of my adolescence. The sound of like a dying hairdryer ineffectually just kind of warming a huge patch of urine.
We did pitch a Raised by Wolves episode which didn't go anywhere. It was called The Two Towers.
Oh yes, which was instead of The Two Towers.
Yeah, reference to Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. And we were like, because towels were a big issue. They were constantly damp. They were constantly had intimate smells on them from other people. We never washed them enough.
We could all easily pick up a towel, sniff it, and say not only who had last used it, but where on the body they had used it. Like, kind of, we were like towel experts.
Yeah. That's disgusting. Oh, yeah, mother.
I know. That's dad's balls. I know, that's Mel. Yeah, like, kind of, like, yeah. There seemed to be only two towels, and they were all both damp and really full of bugs.
Are you always able to be honest with each other? Has that sort of lasted?
Well, I think we're all very wary of... people don't really confront each other head on. We've read a lot about psychology, kind of like a lot of us are deep into sort of Jungian theory. More than any other family I know, we've studied huge amounts about psychology and about the way that groups work, about family dynamics. And then on top of that, because we didn't go to school, we were completely isolated from society. So we only had ourselves to study as if we were on some desert island and we were the tribe that we were studying. And then when we went out in the world and suddenly started meeting people again, it was such an overwhelming shock. And everybody was so different to us that I think we then have spent the rest of our lives basically going, wow, have you met people? They're different. We need to figure them out because they're thinking about things in a really different way to us. And unless we figure this out, we will be alienated from society forever.
This season of Relatively is sponsored by Find My Past, the online home of the 1921 census. In 1921, life in England and Wales could be tough. But there are lots of examples of humour in the census records. Constance Bernard FitzHammond listed her three young children's occupations as getting into mischief and getting into more mischief, and for her 11-month-old baby, occupying feeding bottles. Did your grandparents add a quirky note when they completed the census? View the record itself at findmypast.co.uk to find out.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And what about early memories? What's your sort of earliest memory of being sisters together?
It's tough because I have an absolutely appalling memory, and me I have too. Very, very little memories from my from my childhood. I mean, I'm sure psychologists would think there was a reason for that. But I remember we would go and visit my nan who lived in Womburn, and she had a sort of little bungalow, and it was like a whole other world. She'd let us go in her bedroom, where everything was like very dark wood furniture and had doilies on it. And she had these like glass swans.
I think you remember every single thing you see at that age. So I can remember every single one of her ornaments. She had an owl that changed color according to the weather. Yeah, the glass swans, like she had beautiful cups with beautiful roses and stuff painted on them.
Because there was just there was never anything sort of precious or special in our house, because everything was just a kind of moving chaos of tat and food and clothes and stuff. And so the idea that there would be an object that would be in a place when we sort of go over very reverentially and sort of look at these beautiful glass swans, and it was us together having to, it was like going sort of through the wardrobe into Narnia. Yeah. That was our thing, and it was our special place that we would go.
Is it possible to sort of say whether you're more resilient or less resilient, or whether you reject that word because it's a bit of a ugh word, but do you think your upbringing made you braver and stronger, or has been a kind of barbed gift?
It's difficult. I mean, for me, it's worked out well in that it was lucky that I turned out to be someone who is generally fine being on their own and being allowed to just read and then to write. But I think our family has a very strong awareness that even though we were all very strong individuals, we are also a collective item. Like, a lot of us look so similar facially that if I'm in the car and I look in the rearview mirror, I cannot tell if I'm looking at my own face or one of my two other sisters. Every time we take a group photograph, people will sit around and look at it afterwards and go, which one am I? Like, I once watched my brother jump into a swimming pool and then just disappear from view. And then when his head finally surfaced, he went, I've forgotten. Am I one of the ones that can swim? So there's this idea that we're a collective entity. So however I feel about my childhood, it's only 1/8 of the actual view of it. I'm very aware that everybody had different sort of experiences and stuff. So, and I'm more respectful of their views of what happened than my own, really, because I think I was one of the favored children and it was okay for me. Okay. But for others, it was a less pleasant experience, let's put it like that. So it's like the union. It's like one out, all out. If one of my siblings has a view, I will adopt that view and step behind them.
It's really interesting. I've never heard anyone explain it quite like that, but I guess, as with so many families, as I've learned on this podcast, each family is like its own experiment. I thought there were kind of cookie cutter families out there, and that it would be amazing to get some that kind of deviated from that. But then I've learned that every single family deviates from what you think is normal.
Which is why it's crazy. I mean, you know, now I'm a parent, like, kind of the idea that two human beings without any kind of training or license or genetic checkup or any real discussion about kind of like, you know, the histories of mental and physical illnesses in their families can just start creating people.
Yeah.
And then on top of it, in our family, because we were home educated and just sort of people weren't coming in and out of the house, it was a very concentrated experiment. Like, kind of the only input we had into ourselves was either the library. And, you know, for a long time, we didn't have a TV. So the only input was ourselves and books. It's like a puddle that had just been baked in the sun. Like, kind of at the end of those 5 years, kind of whatever microorganisms sort of mentally and emotionally and creatively were in that puddle, they'd really been boiled down to their essence.
I'm interested by what you said, that you delved into some Jungian psychotherapy, because I heard, and I've read a bit, but I've heard that Jung said that, I think it's one of the greatest tragedies a child could endure is the unlived lives of their parents or unrealized dreams of their parents.
Yes, well, that's very, I mean, yeah, I have, as the young people say, deeped on that quite a lot, because my father, his sort of origin, his whole of the story we were brought up with was that he had been in a band for a while. He'd been in a band as a teenager. He'd run away from home. He was a drummer. They toured all around Germany, sort of following the footsteps of the Beatles. They'd got a record deal and like they almost made it. And then apparently they had this huge row and broke up. So as we were growing up, the myth was that at some point he would like get the band back together, or that he would go solo. He was very inspired by the career of Phil Collins, because Phil Collins had been in a band, Genesis, and then was very successful as a solo artist in the 80s and had also been a drummer. So he was constantly recording these five same songs over and over again. And every year he'd send them off to the record companies. And every year we would think that this would be the year that he would be signed. And finally we would go from being on benefits in this tiny council house in Wolverhampton to being millionaires, to the point where I started to learn the names of all of Bob Geldof's children, because I presumed that as my contemporaries, we would soon move to London and they would be my friends. And then around about the age of 13, when I realized that he wasn't going to make it, like that this was it, that was when I started writing a book, because I was like, well, I will need to earn money, because like this isn't going to happen. And I sort of realize now that this sort of, this idea that like, that entering the creative industries and making money was the only way out if you were working class. My dad would always say the only way you can make your way off a council estate is either you're good at football or like you become a pop star. And then when I started becoming a writer, he was like, oh, you found a third way. That's a third way.
It's an amazing presence of mind to have as a 13-year-old. But I wonder, as a significantly older woman now, you know, middle-aged yourself, you can relate to him. And there's real heartbreak. There's such tragedy in that story. And I think when we see our parents as contemporaries, it's almost unbearable sometimes.
When you grow up, the house that you grow up inside your parents' emotions, basically, don't you? You grow up inside your parents' regrets and hopes, and you don't realise that that's just the atmosphere in your house because that's your whole world. So, yeah, I was very aware that his longing to get back out of Wolverhampton and get back down to London and make money and, like, be in the creative industries again, like, kind of that was why it was a viable option for me. And the relief that he got when I started earning money, I could see that. But I think also maybe pain, because I think he realised, oh, well, that is it. It's the next generation now. Like, my slot has finally gone. Mm. So it was quite complex.
Catelyn was talking about Jungian psychology. She talked a lot about your dad and his hopes to be a musician and to make it, and what that created, what atmosphere that created in the house in terms of what you guys thought was possible or what you needed to do. I wonder how you internalized that or responded to that.
I became very, very frightened when I was about sort of 12, 13, of kind of like, well, because I'm not at school, I'm not going to get any qualifications. And when I would go to the local Quicksave with my mum to buy the £7 of cheese that we bought every week, of which I was eating quite a large quantity, they would have a liquor save booth in the corner, which was a sort of screened off plastic area where you would buy your cheap alcohol. And I would think, that is where I'm going to end up. That will be my job. Not that there's anything wrong with working in a liquor save booth, but I was kind of like, okay, that's as far as I'm going to go. I'm going to go 15 minutes away from the home unless I do something. And my parents' response to that was always, well, why don't you do what Kate did? You know, and I was like, but I can't go be a presenter on Channel 4. Like, that, you know, that's not the career options. I want something that isn't working in the liquor save booth or being a television presenter and journalist. There has to be another way. I then went down the road of kind of getting an education and going to university.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was harder for her because, I mean, ask her to talk about it, but I remember feeling really bad because when I, you know, started earning money as a writer at like the age of 15, that was when I got the book contract, I knew that she wanted to be a writer as well. And the it felt to me, and you must ask her about this, that the whole family was like, oh, well, Kate's a writer now. It was like, well, we've got a writer.
Finally, on your dad, the thing that strikes me as really unusual is that he had these two ways of leaving where you were, and you found a third way. But he also, as well as the world being small and you living inside his aspirations and his dreams and all of those things, he actually, with his dreams, perversely opened up the world to you. He showed you the opportunity, even though he hadn't managed to take it for himself. You were aware of it. I'm guessing lots of kids in similar situations have no idea that creative industries is a way out.
Yes. I mean, that was lucky that he knew that, but it was also a double-edged sword. I think his desperate, I mean, the thing I remember the most is from the age of 11 onwards, I knew I wanted to be a writer from the age of 11. And I would sort of mention this, and he would do these. He's a preacher man. You don't really have conversations with him. He just says stuff, and he does big, inspiring speeches that can often be overwhelming, particularly if you're 11. And he would just do these huge speeches that would get angrier and angrier, just going, well, just do it. You keep saying you want to be a writer. Just do it. Like, I see you there. You're sitting on your ass. Have you written anything today? Well, no. The book's not going to get written on its own. And by the end of these speeches, I would literally be weeping, literally going, but I'm 11. I can't write a book now. And it seemed incredibly unfair. Like, I was filled with this burning injustice that he thought I was lazy for not having written a book at the age of 11. But I now see, and it was horrible, and I would never do that to my children. But I also see that he was trying to convey the reality of what it's like to be on benefits on a council estate in Wolverhampton. It was like, well, unless you do something extraordinary and start really early, you are going to be stuck here. And I think that's one of the hardest things about if you come from, like, you know, a poor family, a working class family. It's really hard not, in a way, you're doing your children a disservice if you don't make them scared, because you do need to make them aware of the massive odds of them succeeding from where they are. If you're in a bad postcode, if you're in a backwater, chances are you're not going to make it. So you will have to do something extraordinary. And in order to do something extraordinary, you have to be quite unhappy and quite pressurized. I'm sure he hadn't, like, worked out this technique in quite the way that I've now understood it through a lot of therapy afterwards. But yeah, I mean, that was the massive favour he did me, was make me astonishingly anxious and terrified from the age of 11 that I should do something quickly, not something that I've passed on to my children.
One of the things that she said was when she did get her book deal, I think she was 15, that she's she felt guilty then, she feels guilty now, that that role was almost swiped off the table. Everyone's like, oh, well, she's the writer. And she said, it's hard because you write too, you both write. And yet it felt like that was gone. And maybe it felt like that was gone for you. And that must have been hard.
It wasn't sort of long after that that she sort of started presenting on television and stuff. There was a sort of a publicness to that that never really appealed to me and that sort of suited her extrovert ways.
Mm.
But, you know, there's definitely there's that whole thing about kind of, you know, you're in the shadow of your, you know, people who've got kind of very successful parents, or that you're sort of living in the shadow of that, and how do you deal with it? And you've got to kind of come to terms with it and have a relationship with that. And, you know, are you going to kind of go in the exact opposite way because that's how you rebel, or do you kind of embrace it? I wasn't serious about writing for quite a long time. I sort of went off to university and studied biology, and, you know, it hadn't ever really occurred to me that I would be a writer. Now, probably, you know, we do work on the same sort of project sometimes, but yeah, we are very kind of different, I guess, in what we do choose to write. I very much like to sort of be in the shadows as a kind of would-be puppet master hiding in the shadows and pulling the strings, whereas she's very much kind of, you know, prepared to be out and seen and be speaking in the world.
The bottom line about Kaz is she's always been funnier. Like, she is genuinely a stone-cold genius. I can remember when she was 3 and I was 5, she came into the room in her 19 and started doing this literal stand-up comedy routine. And everyone was crying, laughing. And I remember in my kind of dolorous 5-year-old way going, she's the funny one now. My time is over. And I've always felt like that about her. Like, she's the one that I bow down to. And if I can make her laugh, I know I've succeeded.
I mean, it's very sweet that she cares whether she can make me laugh. We all, I think, as a family, have a very sort of shared sense of humour. You know, it's kind of been a training ground for all of us. Like, if you can make each other laugh, you know, and there are so many of us, and kind of there is that joy. It's almost like kind of, you know, we're all doing our own little bits around the dinner table to see who can get the best gag. There's definitely funnier even than me and Catelyn, and, you know, in the family, there are comedy master siblings.
Comedy master, like a special ninja unit.
They're not working so hard. I guess me and Catelyn will have a sort of bit of patter, but they will just be, you know, naturally just coming with an absolutely killer one-liner that we could have spent weeks and weeks trying to write and wouldn't come up with. And, you know, they don't have their whole ego invested in it, unlike me and Catelyn, who are probably slightly slavish to getting a laugh.
So this podcast is all about kind of nuclear families, brothers and sisters, mums and dads, and where we came from in our house, if we shared a house when we were younger. But we're also interested in kind of wider family stories, which is why Find My Past kindly has been digging into the Moran family tree. And when we emailed about this, you did say there's a lot of potato farmers, or a lot of potato feature.
Yeah.
And I thought, amazingly, they managed to go back all the way to the 1730s with your family tree, to your great great grandparents, William and Mary Ann Height. Mary Ann's maiden name was Booty. They had 6 children, including Reginald. And Reginald went to school in the 1730s, 1740s in the Cambridge area. They worked as agricultural labourers, so you weren't too far off there.
So they were potato farmers on both sides, because, yeah, like on the Irish side, our dad's side, it's literally wall-to-wall potato farmers. Like, yeah, we've got,
I don't think they're farmers, I think they were digging up those potatoes for money
for other people, yeah, for the English, yeah. But then this is on our mother's side you're talking about, and they were potato farmers too.
I mean, I wouldn't want to say potatoes genuinely, maybe, but
that's a big spud area, East Anglia. It's flat and it's full of potatoes.
That's our heritage,
right
there.
But the sweetest story, and I think this fits in terms of you being feminist radicals, which is how Kaz described you, Catelyn, as a kind of radical in your optimistic attitude that you assumed when you had no right to, really, was the way that she put it, is all about Carrie, Rosina Coe. And she is your grandmother's mother. So her daughter Phyllis is your grandma, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So she was widowed. Was Carrie when your grandmother was just a few months old. So back in those days, that's in 1911, normally you'd go and find another bloke, right? Because you think, this is pretty terrible, I don't have any money, and now my husband's died. And instead, and I love this, she thought, sod that, and she went and opened a glass and china shop in Sudbury and was still running it.
Yeah,
in 1939, at the age of 65. And I quote, she took a very different approach to life than most widows of her generation. Instead of remarrying, she opened a business. It would have been somewhat familiar territory for her, as her parents were involved in furnishings and drapery.
This is why I feel so happy in like the crockery department of John Lewis. Yeah. This is like, this is deep genealogy, right?
Yeah.
Like literally, that's so nice. I love that she had a little Razzie Sharp and she didn't need no dude. That's so cool. Yeah.
So finally, and I'm sure this will be easy, and maybe you have many ways to answer. If you needed to wind up Kaz, like in a heartbeat, what button could you press to make her really annoyed really quickly?
Oh, God. Well, she was very quick to tell the story of how when Jung went to visit Freud, Jung was working on some deep theory about what annoys people, and he decided that the best way to annoy Sigmund Freud was to get a tea towel and keep whipping him on the ass with it whilst going, I just want to see how you react. I just want to see how you react. So I imagine not only because that would be really annoying, but also that I would try and do it in the voice of Jung, and also that it was her fact and anecdote that she knew. So that would be a three-way wind-up, I think.
Well, I think what would annoy me about that is that that didn't famously happen. And so the historical inaccuracy would then immediately wind me up. So that's perfect. I think what used to really, really wind her up was ignoring her, because it was very hard to achieve because we were in such a small area. And she would, there was a sort of phase where she was like, had started music journalism, and she would be very excited about bands and would sort of come into my room, try and connect with me about music, and just, I was just the coldest, most unreceptive, very much like, go away and let me just be depressed in this room. I think she wouldn't, I don't know, she wouldn't really get annoyed. She would just be kind of like, but why? Why don't you want to bond with me? And I think that was, probably quite soul-crushing, I would imagine, which is exactly what I intended it to be at the time.
That's unbearable, yeah. Or if someone questions my generosity. So on this holiday, I brought like 10 panettone, because we're going to have a panettone tasting World Cup. If Kaz just looked at me and went, only 10, then that would destroy me, and she would know that that had destroyed me. I would immediately go out and make another panettone. So yeah, and she wouldn't want the panettone. She just knows that's my sweet spot for pain.
Thank you to Caitlin and Kaz, and thank you too for listening. I'll start asking Caitlin about going to your gran's house.
Yes. Which one? Shit Nan or Good Nan?
I think Good Nan, because she had glass ones you were allowed to go and pick up.
Oh yes. Yeah, Good Nan, yeah.
And a huge thank you to our sponsors, Find My Past, who are offering you the chance to start your family tree for free. Head to findmypast.co.uk to find out more. That's findmypast.co.uk. Enormous thanks as well to Tanita Tikaram for letting us use this amazing song. Additional research this season by Rachel Oakes, and sound design, as always, by Nick Carter at mixsonics.com. We'll be back next week with more sibling stories to share. There's a good tradition of love and hate. Staying by the fireside, there's a good tradition of love and hate. Staying by the fireside, now the rain may fall. Your father's calling you, you still feel safe inside. Although your ma's too proud, your brother's ignoring you, you still feel safe inside. Oh, was it solo? Was it yesterday? Was it true for you? 'Cause while all